Welcome to the Filmtrepreneur Podcast, episode number 51. Once you choose hope, anything's possible. Christopher Reeve.
This is the Filmtrepreneur Podcast, where we teach you the top strategies, tactics, and growth hacks that every indie filmmaker needs to know to make money with their films. We are the podcast that puts the business back into show business. And here's your host, Alex Ferrari.
Welcome to another episode of the Filmtrepreneur Podcast. I am your humble and quarantined host, Alex Ferrari. Today's show is sponsored by Rise of the Filmtrepreneur, how to turn your independent film into a profitable business. It's harder today than ever before for independent filmmakers to make money with their films, from predatory film distributors ripping them off to huckster film aggregators who prey upon them. The odds are stacked against the indie filmmaker. The old distribution model of making money with your film is broken, and there needs to be a change. The future of independent filmmaking is the entrepreneurial filmmaker or the filmtrepreneur. In Rise of the Filmtrepreneur, I break down how to actually make money with your film projects and show you how to turn your indie film into a profitable business. With case studies examining successes and failures, this book shows you the step-by-step method to turn your passion into a profitable career. If you're making a feature film, series, or any other kind of video content, the Filmtrepreneur method will set you up for success. The book is available in paperback, ebook, and of course, audiobook. If you want to order it, just head over to www.filmbizbook.com. That's filmbizbook.com. Before we get started, guys, I set up a special link to help people affected by the coronavirus, and you can donate to Feed America. There is a lot of people in need out there, and Feed America is a great organization, and they're helping millions of people on a daily basis, and they also need your help. If you want to donate, even $5, $10, it goes a long way. Head over to indiefilmhustle.com/help. Now, today on the show, we have one of our original guests, Ben Yenny, who is a producer's rep and also an author and also the CEO and founder of Guerrilla Rep Media, as well as the Producers Foundry and the Amazing Resource Production Next. I mean, he is a busy, busy dude. He is a hustler to say the least. Now, today we're going to talk about not only many of the things that Ben is working on and how the industry is changing and how movies are being made, how you're making money making movies, but we're also going to get into what a producer rep does, how he does it, you know, kind of the confessions of what he's gone through over his career, and really give the tribe some insight to how to hire a producer's rep and how to deal with markets and selling their movies and making money. It is just plumb filled with a lot of great, great, great information. So without any further ado, please enjoy my conversation with Ben Yenny. I'd like to welcome back to the show, returning champion, Ben Yenny, man. Thank you so much for coming back on the show, brother.
Thanks for having me, Alex.
It has been, it's been a minute since you've been. It has been a minute. Yeah. You were one of the very first, I think you were my first interview, but you were like the second or third released. And I think you were episode, and I think we were talking about 15 or 16. Now we will put it in the show notes, but, and you still get action from that three and a half years ago.
And I think you've gotten some, you've gotten some reaction on that indirectly as well from like Josh and Michael.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, yeah. These guys that the film of parts of the Indie Film Whistle Tribe that reached out to you. And actually, as of this recording, Josh's interview is going out today. It's actually going out today. So I'll make sure to link to Ben, to your original interview that got you that gig. And thank you for reaching out with that. But I wanted to bring you back on the show because a few things have changed in the last 3.5 years. Since last we spoke, about the business in general. So today, first I want, for everybody who doesn't know who you are, just give us a real quick update about who you are and what you do in the business.
I am primarily a producer's rep and executive producer in the Bay Area. I do a lot of kind of low budget stuff now, but there's some stuff I can't quite talk about that's much bigger, that should be coming through early next year. I help filmmakers with financing, distribution, marketing, and a bit of packaging too. Okay. So, and in addition to that, I started a company. I helped to start a company called Production Next, but we'll talk about that later.
Cool. And you also wrote a book about the American film market.
I did write a book about the American film market. I've got a couple of books that I've done on that. One is The Guerrilla Rep, which is also on audiobook and in its second edition, and then The State of the Film Industry Report, which is a macroeconomic study of the film industry itself.
Very cool. Which is one of the reasons I wanted to talk to you about I want to have you back on the show because of that amazing book called The State of the Film Industry. And I wanted to get – because you went in with, 3 years of research for that book. And you answer a lot of questions. I'm going to ask you a bunch of those questions in a minute. But first, all the experience you have in the business, you've met hundreds if not thousands of filmmakers over the course of your career. You've worked closely with them through your being a producer's rep or being an executive producer or just even hearing stories like I do every day of filmmakers doing things sometimes right, most of the times wrong. What is the biggest mistake you see filmmakers make when distributing their films?
I think the biggest mistake that costs the filmmaker the most is probably signing with the wrong sales agent or distributor. And that happens a lot. I'm still more a fan of traditional distribution for most filmmakers, but I do understand that it's much better, much, much, much better to self-distribute your film than to end up with the wrong distributor or sales agent. The trick is ending up with the right ones who can right. open some doors that you probably can't open yourself.
Go ahead.
Unless you have a huge following on social media, which is probably the other thing is I've talked to a lot of filmmakers who think social media is just a waste of time and establishing community and all of that is not worth the time you have to put into it. And that's just flat out wrong.
Very, very much so, without question. And I actually have been speaking a lot lately about self-distribution versus traditional distribution. And there are pluses and minuses on both ends. But self-distribution mm-hmm. is not for everybody. I think you would agree with that. It's not for every film. It's not for every filmmaker. You got a filmmaker who made $500,000 movie, has no stars in it, has no online presence, and yet says, I'm going to self-distribute this and I'm going to put it up on iTunes and Amazon and let the money roll in. They're done. Would you agree?
I would totally agree.
Now, what are the dangers filmmakers should look out for when signing with a distributor? Like, what are those kind of things that you just go, every time I read this in a contract, that's not a good sign?
Okay. There are a couple of key points on there, which are really good to look for. The biggest ones are the percentage the distributor takes. Mm-hmm. The sales agent takes, not the distributor. It's a bit of a different game when you're talking about distributors. But for sales agents, if they're taking more than 30 or 35%, it's probably already to the point that you don't really want to be doing that contract with them mm-hmm. because you can never negotiate that down. Mm-hmm. And if they're starting at that level, it's generally indicative that a lot of the other things in the contract are going to be bad as well. It's not the only thing to pay attention to, and it's not necessarily a deal breaker. Mm. It just means that it's likely there's going to be at least one other deal breaker along the way.
And then as far as just explain to a lot of people who don't know what the difference between a sales agent and a distributor is. Can you just tell quickly what that is?
Yeah, a sales agent deals with distributors and generally works with local distributors to sell the entire world. And the local distributor will actually distribute generally within a specific territory or sometimes only specific rights within a territory, depending on what sort you're dealing with. Like Starz or Showtime or HBO would technically be a distributor who are primarily dealing with US pay TV and SVOD rights. So
got it.
Yeah.
And then so 30 or 40. So if someone's asked, if you're a filmmaker and a sales agent is asking for 30-35%, which is insane, for a rate, then that's probably a telltale sign. You probably should not be doing that deal. How about if you're a filmmaker going straight to a distributor, which a lot of filmmakers, most filmmakers go straight to a distributor, because sales agents sometimes are great for certain films, but sometimes, you know, if a movie costs 15 grand, probably don't need a sales agent. If a film, you know, it depends on the kind of film it is, but on a going straight to a distributor, what are those kind of telltale signs that you're like, these guys are not going to do anything for me?
So yeah, the going straight to a distributor is tricky, because as much as you'd really like to go to good distributors straight off, it's actually a lot of times very difficult for a filmmaker to do that directly. A lot of times you will need to go through a sales agent or a producer's rep to get to them. Mm-hmm. But in the instances where you don't, that deal often looks more like 30-40% if it's a revenue share deal.
Yeah.
And that's not necessarily bad right there, but one thing you definitely need to look at is what the size of the minimum guarantee is. If they're not offering a minimum guarantee, you need to understand what their marketing and distribution plan is. And you also, and if they're off, and sometimes people will offer you screens without a minimum guarantee. Mm-hmm. If you can get the screen, the theatrical screens, that can be worth giving up the minimum guarantee, because you can actually end up making significantly more than you might be able to if you just get the minimum guarantee. However, if you made a $15,000 to $20,000 film and somebody's offering you a $25,000 minimum guarantee, more than likely just take the $25,000 minimum guarantee.
Amen. Amen. If someone's giving you $10,000 more than you paid for the movie, I mean, you know as well as I do, that does not happen.
I actually lost a film because somebody else offered them that. I'm doing a bit of U.S. direct U.S. myself now.
Okay.
So I actually may have lost a film because that happened to them. And then as soon as they said they had that, I'm like, yeah, I can't be that offer. Just now, go with
that. Go, yeah, take that money and run.
Yeah, just go. But the even though I was offering to do a limited theatrical for them, but that was just like, no, one in hand is worth at least two in the bush.
At least, without question. Now, you and I saw each other again at AFM this year, which is always always fun to see each other. We see each other, I think, maybe once a year if we're lucky. But AFM, even the few years that I've been going, I've noticed the change in the shift. Everybody was talking about OTTs, SVOD, TVOD, AVOD. And of course there was still the traditional stuff as well, which is, you know, selling overseas and selling, you know, that kind of stuff. But, it is changing. In your opinion, how is AFM changing? And how is it kind of moving in the future?
So in order to understand how it's changing, you kind of have to go back a little bit, because the way AFM and other similar film markets came to be was actually with the rise of VHS replication back in the 80s. Mm-hmm. And the way it was so profitable and the way you could afford all these massive market fees is when it started, you could make a VHS for between $10 and $20 and wholesale it for $100.
Yeah, I know.
And you actually move a lot of them. And then over time, that number dropped and dropped and dropped and dropped. And then DVD came in and replaced VHS. But because it was so cheap to replicate DVD, you could still make a huge profit on each unit. And also, it really opened up the market for smaller content to actually become more profitable on it. Now, people expected Blu-ray to take over for DVD, and it really didn't. Blu-ray did come in and take an okay market share, but it was nowhere near what DVD was, and TVOD, AVOD, and SVOD just don't pay the same way that TVOD, that physical media pays. Mm-hmm. And so that is really what happened, and that's kind of how the bottom's fallen out. And a lot of the older distributors never really adapted their old systems where you could actually charge these huge recoupable expenses and still make money. Now you will never hit it. Most small indie films, I hate to say this, but most small indie films only end up making about $20,000 to $30,000 over the 5-year life of their film. There are lots of exceptions
here. Of course.
But the general rule is you've got to kind of figure that it's more like $20,000 to $30,000 for the film itself over the 5-year life of the film. Mm-hmm. And that's just not really sustainable because the
go ahead.
So you can't really make a business that actually pays filmmakers on that anymore, and I think that's really coming through, and that's why a lot of sales agents and distributors who go to AFM often get a bad rap, even if some of them are not necessarily bad sales agents or distributors. It's just that their models are bad. Mm-hmm. That's not to say there aren't people who are bad sales agents and distributors.
Oh, there are.
There definitely are.
Many.
So that's kind of what's going on there. And now that everybody's only really looking for AVOD, SVOD, or TVOD, it's really become more a game of marketing than it has a game of sales agents or distribution, because really the direct local distributor, the way you can tell whether or not they're good is if they can actually get you publicity and actually have a list to market to and a brand that they can market the content they acquire to.
But let me ask you, how many distributors do you know that do that? There's very few that I even know of. Even some of these big boys that say they do it, when you mm-hmm. look behind the curtain, if it's the big boys, obviously, if it's a major, if it's Warner Brothers, if it's Fox Searchlight, I mean, you're talking about those kind of guys, it's different. But, and I'm not gonna call out the distributors I have in my head right now, but there are these guys that promote themselves as like, we're the big indie guys. Like, you know, I'm not talking about A24 or The Orchard or any of these kind of guys. I'm talking about some other ones, but that they say they're going to do a lot and they have this reputation of saying they're going to do a lot. But at the end of the day, I've talked to filmmakers again and again and again, mm-hmm. and they just don't do it anymore. So just curious, is there any distribution companies that you could call out that you go, you know what? These guys are pretty good in my experience.
So I will actually call a couple of good people out, mm-hmm. more for distribution than for sales agencies. Mm-hmm. But Parade Deck Films, Michael Ingram, I've worked with directly, and I've worked with pretty extensively directly. And I was a big fan of working with him, and I would work with him again in a heartbeat. Mm-hmm. Another one that I think is really good, and there's something of a hybrid between sales agency and distributor. They do most of the VOD in the US directly, but they also do some international sales for the right projects. That's Leo Mark Studios. I think they're great and their recoupable expenses are really, really low, mm-hmm. Which is great. And their commission, I don't want to say what the commission is, but it's also very low. So those are a couple of the people that I would deal with. And I think they're a little bit better about publicity, mm-hmm. than some of the other ones. In terms of who actually does well in marketing and developing their brand, I think Devilworks is great, mm-hmm. At marketing and developing their brand. And they actually do pay. Mm-hmm. and they are Mateo and Samantha are great. And they are very good about publicity. Mm-hmm. I think they have at least one publicist on retainer that is just constant. And I think they do bigger market pushes when the time comes. Again, they're more of a sales agent than mm-hmm. they are a distributor, but they are very good at what they do.
That sounds awesome, because generally what I hear is, you know, distributors are just like, oh yeah, yeah, we're gonna charge you $30,000 or $40,000 for recuperable expenses for marketing and going to the markets and all that kind of good stuff. But at the end of the day, all they do is they put it up on their social media, which is pathetic, and they just put it out on the platforms, and that's the end of it. And then the filmmaker's like, but why am I not making any money? I signed everything over and I've locked up my film for 7 years with these guys and they're not doing anything for me. So that sounds refreshing by these, what you're telling me.
So yes, and I'm not trying to paint too rosy a picture here. Those are the people that I've dealt with personally, and I follow them closely because I've worked with them. That's not to say everybody who says they'll do this will not actually, or will actually live up to what they say they'll do. Mm-hmm. So having said that, another thing you should be doing as a filmmaker, and this might have come up in the last podcast, but it's something I almost always negotiate in for my clients, is in a lot of times I structure my acquisition that I'm going to then sell to somebody else in such a way that I can't actually give it to this other person. Mm-hmm. But always, always, always retain the right to sell the film through your website.
Oh, yeah.
Always. Even if all you have is Vimeo on demand or Vimeo OTT through your website, always, always, always keep that.
Distributors don't really fight too much on that.
No, they don't. I've never had somebody really fight me on it. And the most they might say is, okay, we're okay with you doing that, but let's keep an open dialogue about timing with it.
Sure. Like, don't pop it. Yeah. Right.
Yeah.
That makes perfect sense. So,
but that is the big thing there. And I think that's fine. But if you don't do that, you should be doing that. And I think it's just my distribution contract has gone through a couple iterations, but I believe the current draft actually has that as an automatic exclusion for you as a filmmaker for US. So,
very cool. Now I wanted to just talk a little bit about the 5,000-pound gorilla in the room, whose first name begins with Net and ends with Flicks, and how they've literally have changed. I mean, I've never seen a company come in and completely disrupt the entire film industry in a way that is so, I mean, they have now become the big studio in town. I mean, they are making Netflix, I just read, are making 90 feature films in 2019, 90 released films. And a lot of them are ranging from 20 million to 200 million, including like Scorsese and Soderbergh, mm-hmm. and these monster Ben Affleck's new movies coming out. Like it's like the Will Smith and all these big stars are going there. And also this big behind the scenes talent. I mean, Roma, it might get an Oscar nomination this year, and it's going to be a Netflix film by Alfonso. So I'm curious from your perspective, because you were here before Netflix showed up. You were working in the business a bit before Netflix showed up, and how it's completely just changed everything. What's your opinion on what they've done, what they're doing, and what they're going to continue to do moving forward?
Okay. This is going to be, I don't think this is the answer you were expecting.
Good.
At least the end of it. But the first bit is, I think they definitely have changed it. I really don't like their acquisitions strategy. Mm-hmm. They pay far too little. I have a number that they pay, but I really don't want to say that publicly.
I know that number too. it's not very good.
No, it's not. And they also tend to acquire all rights, world rights for that, even though most of the time they just use domestic SVOD for the area they acquire from, not even like US, but I've heard the same coming out of like Brazil. So I don't think that's really a good strategy that helps the industry as a whole. And it doesn't help filmmakers actually make money with their projects. Now, that is only talking about their acquisitions model, and I think just the ubiquity of Netflix has made it desirable for a lot of filmmakers, but I do think it needs to be a later distribution window when you work with them, if you work with them at all, even though it's likely to be an even smaller distribution, even smaller deal than you would be able to get otherwise, if you can even get it at all, because lately they've only been acquiring things that have had a theatrical release of at least $250,000. That's what I heard last. But the other one, but now that's their acquisitions process. Their original process is very interesting in that it looked for a long time like they were basically going to become the next studio. Now, the issue with that is that they haven't really diversified their income streams. All of it comes from their subscription payments, and they have been taking on a significant portion of debt. I haven't looked at this number in a couple weeks, so it might be off. But I believe the amount of debt they're holding right now is between $8 and $9 billion dollars. And that is something that I would be worried about, especially with other 50,000 pound gorillas entering the market like Disney.
Apple.
Yes. And a lot of other people. I don't know if Netflix is going to be able to maintain their first in advantage, because that's a lot of what they've built so far. They were the first people really successfully doing this sort of streaming. And that advantage doesn't last forever, which is why they're trying to innovate with new content. But a lot of the other people who are entering in have a much more diversified business where they can lose money on this product line as they're getting it out, which is a lot of what Amazon Prime did when it was really trying to establish a foothold here. Now, I think this is the part that I'm not sure will be a popular opinion, but I would not be surprised to see a Netflix acquisition in the next in 2019 or early 2020.
I've heard of that.
And I'd be guessing that it would be by Apple, Microsoft, or Facebook, and I also wouldn't rule out Disney as a possible one, because Disney has acquired similar technology even in the past, even when they take a loss on what they've developed so far. But I don't necessarily think that this sort of acquisition is outside the realm of possibility for Disney.
What would be the cost on buying something like Netflix? It's not going to be it's not going to be under $10 billion. It's going to probably be in the 60, 50, 60, $70 billion world, if not more. And there are few companies, the ones you just said, all pretty much almost could. I'm not sure Disney could right now, especially with what they're doing, but Apple could write a check and not even blink tomorrow if they wanted it.
Cash reserves. Yeah.
Do they have cash reserves? So they could, they could buy Netflix tomorrow and not even think twice about it. Microsoft would be interesting. I'd be curious to see how they would do it. They would really be making a big jump, and I'm not sure they're personally, I don't think they're that innovative. I'm an Apple guy. Sorry.
I agree. Also, I really hope it's not Microsoft, because I can guarantee you that
they'll destroy it.
They'll be putting ads on Netflix.
Yeah.
It'll just be, yeah.
They'll destroy it. They'll destroy it. No, but I agree with you. And this is a very interesting conversation, because you're right with their business model isn't diversified. I mean, sure, they have some IP stuff that they license out for, like Stranger Things and Narcos and other things, like t-shirts and hats, and great, that's all nice and dandy, but that's not a huge revenue stream for them. If they're going to survive the long term, they are going to need some sort of other diversification in their business model, because if Disney Plus doesn't go, Disney doesn't go down. If Amazon Prime Video doesn't go, Amazon could give two craps. All these other companies, Hulu is Hulu. I think they fall in that same kind of world of, but they're such a weird, they're owned by like three or four studios. It's just a different beast. But Disney Plus will be an interesting thing. Apple is just waiting. because when Apple wants to go, they're the big guys, and they could crush all of them in a heartbeat. Like Apple could buy Disney. You know?
Yeah, it's
They literally could buy Disney if they wanted to. That's how big Apple is. It's just they haven't decided to go down that road. They keep putting their toe in with, you know, Apple Music and Apple this and Apple Video. They're just trying to put their toes in right now. But when they come, they're going to come hard. I'm curious to see how Netflix agreed. But I've heard about the from distributors, actually, that they're taking forever to pay because they have so much debt. And, you know, even if someone – give you – $100,000 for your movie, they're going to pay it off over the course of the next 2 or 3 years. So it's only a handful of thousands every month, every quarter, which is horrible for the filmmaker. I had to deal with that with Hulu. But their debt is something substantial. But you know what? So was Amazon's for a long time.
Yes, it was. But Amazon had a much more diversified business model even back then.
Right.
I mean, that was a lot higher of a customer lifetime value than Netflix. So, yeah.
Yeah. And I'm really curious to see what Disney Plus does because I'm going to sign up for Disney Plus. I mean, it has everything I want. My kid's going to want to watch stuff on it. It's, you know, of course, the two Star Wars shows. That alone opens the door. For me, as you can see, my Yoda in the background. It's going to be really interesting to see how it all plays out. But I'll throw my hat in the ring. Indie Film Hustle TV obviously is up there with. No, I'm joking. In all honesty, though, running Indie Film Hustle TV, which is an SVOD platform and a TVOD platform, dealing with distributors, dealing with deals. Looking at content, how content is treated by distributors, how, you know, from people who I've signed with, people who I've not signed with, how it's running through my system and how revenue is being generated for those filmmakers. It has been eye-opening, you know, being on this side of the fence, being a little very mini Netflix, in my world with Indie Film Hustle TV. It's been so educational, so eye-opening in the business. It's fascinating, fascinating.
Yeah, no, that sounds good. I think it, in 2019 is going to be in a really, I think it's going to be a really eye-opening year, and it's going. I think the industry is going to be in for a really interesting set of change. I also am among the people, and there are a lot of us who are almost certain that we're in for a recession before the end of 2019.
Oh, absolutely. There's no question.
Yeah.
There's no question. Yeah. At the end of the year, we're gonna get hit with something so hard people have no understanding of it. I already, it's happening. No question.
Yeah. No, I completely agree. And the last time that happened was in 2008, going back to the film market thing a little bit. And that was the last major change for the American film market and film markets in general. And they still haven't fully recovered. They kind of started to get a little bit close this year. But if we have another huge hit to the economy, I don't know what's going to happen to that sector of it. And I think it's going to be really interesting to watch.
But wouldn't it be interesting though, like, if, you know, when this next recession does hit, will people drop their Netflix? Because that's going to be the most affordable, the most affordable entertainment they're going to have. You know, are they going to drop their YouTube TV? You know, like, how much, because they're going to look, even in the worst recessions, movie business always stays. TV is people watching TV, all that kind of stuff. But, you know, $10.99 or whatever Netflix is now, $12.99, whatever it is now, is not that expensive for a lot of content. And then Amazon Prime and all that kind of stuff. I'm curious to see how much of those are affected, as much as going to the movie theaters maybe or other kind of media.
You and I are very much on the same page. I'm thinking that SVOD, that AVOD's going to rise.
Oh,
SVOD
yeah.
might rise a little bit, but won't be huge. And I think TVOD theatrical and a couple of other things are going to, and cable subscriptions are going to take an even bigger hit than they already have.
Oh no. I cut my cord already. It's ridiculous.
Yeah, I know. I think it's just the last little bit of, God, I can't afford this anymore. It's so easy. We're going to get people beyond the age, beyond, like, currently it's under 40s don't have much cable at all. Mm-hmm. I think we're going to be looking at even like under 50s and possibly even under 60s not cutting, which is that's pretty substantial, because that age group tends not to change a lot. Mm-hmm. So
without question. Now let's get into the state of the film industry. I know we've talked a little bit about the state of the film industry, but I want to get into a little bit about your book and what insane stats you were able to get. I'm going to ask you a handful of questions from the book and see how much you can and cannot tell me without people buying the book. But there's so much information in there. I'm sure these questions are not going to hurt people. People want it. So how many active filmmakers are there in the U.S. as you see it? Because that's a number I always wanted to know personally, because my main market is filmmakers. I want to get my information out to filmmakers and my content out to them.
So I believe that number is between 120 and 130,000, but I don't actually have a copy of the book in my office right
now. Okay.
And this is one that normally I reference. I actually took my copy home last night and forgot to bring it back.
I thought it would be more than that. I thought it would be a lot more. Well, that's just filmmakers. That's not people interested in content creation. That's a whole other number.
That is a different number. I considered active filmmakers who make at least one short film every year, or have at least in the past year. I think the other number was that was the easiest way to quantify it. Mm-hmm. And the way we came to that number was we took the number of one question we asked was how many film school grads how did you graduate from film school as opposed to our entire sample? And it was about 37% or so that did graduate. And then I was able to find a total number of film school graduates from the National Education Association and then do algebra to make an estimate based on how many active filmmakers there were per year. And then I was able to do more algebra based on a different question to figure out the average career life of a filmmaker, which turned out to be around 8.3 years, and then figured that out. And we ended up with that number, which I believe is 120 to 130,000.
And then, from there, there's also people who are screenwriters who are interested in screenwriting, who are interested. So these are active people, not people who are interested or are actively trying to get into the business. These are people who are actually doing things.
Yes, they are self-identified as a filmmaker, not an interested person, not a content creator.
Got it.
Specifically as a filmmaker.
Got it. So. Got it. Now, how many films are made a year? How many independent films are made a year, give or take?
Feature around 10 to 12,000.
That's a lot.
Yeah, and that's just U.S.
And by the way, everyone listening, this is just U.S. numbers. We're not, I mean, worldwide, these numbers will balloon. I could tell you that from my audience alone, that I know so much interest is overseas as well. The 10 to 12,000 this year alone, 14,197 films were submitted to Sundance. That's how many.
That's isn't it?
That's including shorts. Yes, that's including shorts as well. But total was 14,200 basically. And that's insane. Now, how many shorts? Did you have a shorts number? That has to be in the...
Yeah, there was a shorts number. I didn't commit that one to memory though. So it is a... actually, the slide... I'm just going to pull it up on the Production Next blog real quick. You can find this in a lot of the report for free on the Production Next blog, by the way. Which is where I'm going to go now. But the But yeah, the last we actually measured web series, TV episodes, shorts, and we tried to get an estimate of web content. That's one that I'm not super sure of, because it's such a variable term depending on where you draw that line. But the total number is I vastly understated the total number of filmmakers. It's actually closer to 200,000.
Okay.
But the and I also understated the indie feature films. We're actually looking more like 18,000 on 18 to 20,000.
Okay.
And total project is the total number of corporate and industrial movies is films that are made is around 130,000. Web new media is around 275,000. Shorts is around 120,000. And TV episodes, this one is very highly variable. The margin of error is much higher on this than other places, but it's around 55 to 103,000 TV episodes that are made.
That's insane. That's a lot of content. But the 18,000 feature films really is kind of like scary, because now you are trying to compete every year with 18,000 other feature films trying to get attention from eyeballs and trying to get their movie sold. And how many – I would love to know the number. How many of those never see the light of day? Like, I'm sure there's many.
I would love two, but the yeah, that is I would love to do this again. This data was originally collected in 2014, so doing it in 2019 is a really
This is 5 year old data. So then, oh my god! Yeah. So then the numbers definitely could even be much bigger than they are now, without question. That's insane. Now, how much do filmmakers make generally a year? And I'd love to know, like, what's the average money that they actually can make a year?
Specifically from their content, I'm on the slide now. I haven't gotten to it yet. What do you know? There it is. Filmmaking content, most people make less than 10,000. Two-thirds of the market makes less than 10,000 from filmmaking. And the average is somewhere near 20,000 total. Our data skewed a little young, just because of how we got it. Most of our results came from IndieWire. And it's a little young, but the but yeah, the biggest interesting thing is that filmmakers' household income, as opposed to their filmmaking income, is actually fairly substantially higher than the national average. Whereas filmmaking income from filmmaking is very much lower, which tends to imply. Yeah.
So you're saying that people that work in the business have a higher income than, you know, just in general, like, you know, guys who work in post or guys who work on set or, you know, girls who are writing or doing other or doing cinematography or whatever, those household incomes are making more money as opposed to just revenue from the content they create.
No, this is actually more. I would have loved to be able to estimate that metric, but we didn't ask the right questions for it. We had originally planned this as a two-part survey, where we did the wide one, which is one we got out now, and then did a smaller one that answered more of the questions that you're asking about right now. But unfortunately, we didn't get quite enough of a sample size to be able to effectively do that. It would have been more of a focus group, and I didn't want to publish anything that wasn't
bigger.
So that was the big thing there. We did get this is not a tiny sample size, though. I think the total number of completed surveys was around 675, and the total number of started was around 1,100.
Okay.
So it's not, it is a representative sample. But the, that's actually approaching the size of most Gallup polls, just as a reference.
Now let me ask you a question. Does film school matter? According to your metrics, sir?
Yes, in ways I didn't necessarily expect. Okay. You're more likely to actually have filmmaking be your primary source of income if you graduate from film school. If you drop out, you are less likely to get it than having not gone to film school at all. However, you're more likely to have a higher household income, including money from other sources, if you go to a school besides film school itself, even if you primarily identify as a filmmaker.
So then film school, are filmmakers going to film school more and more? Did you say that? I remember you saying 37% went to film school.
Graduated from film school. Total went is a different number because we tracked both. Where is that metric?
That's an interesting number. I wouldn't have expected that as much. I thought that film school would be going down. Attendance would be going down on film schools in general.
Keep in mind that this is, from
2014.
This is data from 2014. And I think the real emergence in, being able to educate yourself as a filmmaker online has come since then. So that is the thing. This report was largely unfunded and I did most of the analysis in my limited spare time. That's why it took years to get it out. But, so that is a yeah, and most of the time filmmakers did yeah, the most startling statistic here is that if you graduated from film school, 58% of the respondents' primary income was from filmmaking. Let me rephrase that. 58% of respondents took their primary income from filmmaking. And if you dropped out, that number was about 30%. Mm-hmm. And if you went to other education, it was about 35%.
Obviously this was taking, you said, about 2014. So Indie Film Hustle didn't come in until 2015. So obviously all that education for free would have skewed numbers of today, obviously.
I mean, totally, completely. But yeah. it is a
– Go ahead.
Go ahead.
No, you go ahead.
Another interesting thing about the economics of being a filmmaker as it relates to going to film school, filmmakers who went to film school are more likely to be paid across all departments than those who didn't.
Interesting.
And actually, the inverse is largely true for people who went to other forms of education. They're even less likely than to be both active and paid than people who dropped out of film school. However, there are some notable exceptions, particularly as producers and just other production.
Got it.
Members.
Got it. And we're talking about, and these numbers are for filmmakers. These are directors. These are people who are making content, not cinematographers, not other crew members, not post guys, not first ADs, none of these kind of people. We're talking about these numbers are strictly filmmakers, content creators within the film business, correct?
Actually, there are a mix of them. Most the by far the most people who responded identified as producers and directors. However, we do have a surprisingly strong showing from people we labeled camera department, which tended to be cinematographers,
sure.
As well as people who were kind of trying to rise the ranks through other production and post facilities. So, yeah.
Now, how much money is actually spent on indie film projects every year? Do you have that number?
I do, but I have to go back to it.
Okay.
I have a total market spend for – this is specifically for the long tail. Mm-hmm. The overall last I checked, which I think was around 2014, was around $85 billion domestically, specifically for the film industry. But the vast majority of that goes to places like Disney,
sure,
and Netflix.
Sure, sure.
Of those.
Sure.
But talking about the long tail – it's around a $6 billion industry of independent feature films.
Wow.
5.8, of which about 2.46 are indie feature films. The next biggest chunk is, unsurprisingly, corporate and industrials.
So 2.5 billion are spent a year on independent film projects.
Correct.
The features.
Okay. Yes.
And that was, again, in 2014. So I can only imagine where that number is today as well. It just gives us a good reference. It gives us a good reference, mm-hmm, on what's being spent, how is it being spent, how is it being recouped, and so on. Ben, thank you, man, for giving us those numbers and doing all that hard work, because I've always wanted to know a bunch of these numbers. And even though they might not be completely, totally up to date, it gives you a good reference point to start from, and just add 5 years to it, and you can see how much it could actually have blown up since then. I want you to also tell me about Production Next and what you guys are doing. It's with the platform, with the blog, and what you're doing with that. It's very exciting stuff.
Production Next is a project management system specifically for independent film, video, and all the sorts of projects we alluded to here. It's meant to be one place for literally everything in the film industry. And it has three primary components. The first is all-inclusive project management. And by that, I mean we do breakdowns, strip boards, budgets, call sheet generation. Actually, we designed our call sheet, I think, really in a really cool way, in that you can, with about three clicks, generate a call sheet with all of the information, all of the addresses, sun up, sun down time, based on your GPS location, as well as weather by the hour based on your GPS location, in about three clicks, and send it all to your entire crew that's scheduled to be there with another click. And that's that. And that's a lot of the design philosophy on this. We're trying to make a lot of the things that are kind of tedious and can be made simpler. Mm-hmm. And we're doing as much as we can from that on a technological level. And it's completely cloud-based, so your entire crew stays up to date. You're always looking at the most recent documents and the most recent information. And that's the project management system. The second system is a company management system. That's what we're calling it. It basically lets you keep track of your real-world assets, because as a filmmaker, you acquire props, wardrobe, equipment, set dressing, access to locations, and a large contact list. And we let you keep track of all of those real world assets and then plug them directly into your project while detecting conflicts. So nothing's ever supposed to be in two places at once across multiple projects. And then the other one is a community feature, which is basically to help you find the stuff you need but don't have, including information from our blogs, including a lot of stuff. We also have groups. I believe you have a group, Alex.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I do have. We have an indie film hustle group there.
Yeah, and we will be, and we can put a link to join that in here, mm-hmm. I believe. And the so you can just join there, and it's a good way to keep in touch with other people, other filmmakers who have similar interests, as well as post classifieds, ask questions of people who actually would know the answer. Like if you're asking a financing question, you can ask it of executive producers. And if I'm in that group or that area, there's a good chance you get an answer from me. And you can also do other things like just hold threaded discussions and even keep up to date with information, with basic profile information of other people in the group and other projects in the group. Of course, you don't see the budget or anything like or anything sensitive like that. It's a it's very similar to what you'd find on a project's website or a Facebook page.
Got it. So you got a lot of stuff going on at Production Next.
Yeah.
That's awesome. No, congratulations. I know you've been working on it for years now and trying to get it mm-hmm. up and running, and it's doing well now. So if definitely anyone listening or watching, definitely check it out. It is it will help you with your projects and help you make life a little easier for you as a filmmaker. Using the service without question. I have a few questions to ask all my guests. What advice mm-hmm. would you give a filmmaker wanting to break into the business today?
Learn how to produce. Even if you want to be a director, even mm-hmm. if you want to be a DP, learn how to produce. There is people, even people who identify as multiple things, you're much more likely to be successful if you identify as a producer. And I do actually have data to back that up. Mm-hmm. So that's the first thing. Second, build your social media presence. Any sort of content-driven career these days requires you actually have a community and a social media following if you're going to do it successfully. And finally, learn as much as you can and get your network as big as you can get it. You never know how you never know what contact might pay off later on down the line.
Amen.
I've been surprised by a couple. Yeah.
Amen. I mean, look, you did a little podcast that was on episode 15 3.5 years ago, and it's still paying off.
Even then. This is true. Yeah.
Now, can you tell me what book had the biggest impact on your life or career?
I feel like it's not cool to say my own book because it's actually not the information in it that sure. did it, but it did actually really help grow my career a lot. Mm-hmm. So aside from that, probably Freakonomics.
Oh, that's a great book. Great documentary too. Love yeah. that doc. I love that doc too. Now, what lesson took you the longest to learn, whether in the film business or in life?
While there's always stuff to be done, working 60, 70 hours a week consistently is not generally the way to do it. My wife still has to remind me of that one sometimes. So.
As good wives do, sir. As good wives do. Now, what are three of your favorite films of all time?
I'd say A Knight's Tale.
Yeah, I love that movie. That's a great movie.
Gattaca is also up there.
Another good one.
And The Princess Bride.
Of course. Great movie. Great movie. Rest in peace, William Goldman. That was such a great book. I mean, not only a great book, but a great movie. And now, where can people find you, sir?
Easiest is probably through my Facebook page, which is either facebook.com/thegorillarep or facebook.com/productionnext. And then there's probably also thegorillarep.com. And I give away a free film market resource pack through there. And you can join Production Next for free. We give so much away for free there. At productionnext.com/IFH.
Very cool, brother. Thanks again, man, for jumping back on and dropping some knowledge bombs on the tribe today. I truly, truly appreciate it. And hopefully we won't wait another 3.5 years to have you back.
I want to thank Ben for coming on and dropping some major knowledge bombs on the tribe today. Thank you. Thank you so, so much, Ben. If you guys are looking for a good producer's rep who's honest and does what he says he's going to do, then definitely check Ben out. You can find his information at the show notes at filmtrepreneur.com/051. Thank you again for listening, guys. As always, be a filmtrepreneur. Stay safe out there, and I'll talk to you soon.
Thanks for listening to the Filmtrepreneur podcast at filmtrepreneur.com.